This is the eighth class in the series under the general theme, How to Master the Secrets of Bible Study. And this class is entitled, How to Set Effective Spiritual Goals Using Bible Examples. Brother Roger.
Well, thank you, Brother Chairman, and good morning, my dear brothers and sisters and young people. I just want to reiterate the comments of the Chairman, is that if you think you're here for Sunday school, you might find this morning somewhat puzzling, because you're not going to open your Bibles. But what we're going to conclude with are some thoughts that are obviously related to biblical matters, because we're going to talk about biblical heroes and biblical examples that we might take to ourselves in terms of our own spiritual journey. But this class was really intended as, in some measure, the summation of what we've covered at our Schools of the Prophets weekend over the course of the last day and previous evening. And what we wanted to cover this morning was really the reality of the fact that in order to become committed to the work of the truth, and in order to be involved in developing our personal spiritual goals, we need to know some of the practicalities of how we might attend to the wise use of our attention, the wise management of our time, and the wise allocation of our resources. And so this morning in measure is of a somewhat practical nature towards some of those realities, because we have to face them if we're going to be disciplined in our spiritual journey towards the kingdom. I'd like to start with a passage from Brother Robert Roberts, who once said this. He said, "Nothing useful was ever done without a towering resolution that went far in purpose and desire beyond that which it was possible to accomplish." They're stirring words, aren't they? And these are the words of a man who accomplished an enormous amount in the work of the truth, whose example would leave us feeling exhausted just to contemplate the magnitude of his labours. And when you read a comment like that from such a brother, it's clear that our brother had not only commitment of intention, but must have managed his resources, his time and his attention, so that he could accomplish a very significant amount in the service of the Lord whom he sought to follow. And it's that spirit of finding that sense of purpose in life and that resolution to go with that that we're going to address briefly this morning. And I'm just going to talk for a few moments about goal setting and the twin axes of good goals. I think perhaps even Christadelphians sometimes set New Year resolutions. And most Christadelphians, like most other people, find that the setting of their New Year resolutions has failed by about the 1st of February. And the reason for that is because we don't understand the dynamic of what it means to set goals. Because, you see, there's an enormous difference between goal setting and goal achieving. And the two things are not the same. And most people are quite good at setting goals, but they never figured out how to achieve them. And this is something that's relevant in terms of our work life and our personal life, but perhaps even more so in the context of our spiritual life. If we're going to set goals, and I think we should in the matters of the truth, we certainly learn to do this in terms of our mundane day-to-day labours. Why should we not apply that in spiritual things as well? So there's a process to goal achieving that is important to understand, so that whatever we've set as goals, we have some possibility of accomplishing them. Well, here they are, because I think there's seven steps for goal achievement, and they are as follows. The first thing that we need to do is to visualise the outcome, so that when we've decided upon a goal, whatever it might be, think about this in the context of even your home life, or ecclesial life, or personal spiritual life, or your work and career life. The first thing we've got to do with any goal is to visualise it so clearly that we can write it down. Is it clear enough for you to be able to visualise it? That's important. Sometimes goals are very vague. And goals that are vague will tend to not stimulate the mind and encourage the heart towards them. They've got to be specific and they've got to be vivid and they've got to be real, and we've got to be able to visualise them. And only when we visualise that goal can we start to then decide how we might move forward with it. Now, there's a known method for how that should be achieved. That once a goal has been visualised, that we should then brainstorm the strategies that might be possible to bring that goal to fruition or fulfilment. And one of the benefits of brainstorming is you might think that what we normally do for that is we take either a large sheet of paper or a whiteboard and we simply cascade those ideas out onto the board in random order as they come. It's truly a brainstorm. And we deliberately allow that to be so because at that point of time, the only thing we're wanting to do is to allow our brain to contemplate all the possible things that might be brought into play for the successful bringing of that goal into fruition. And it's only after we've brainstormed that we can then look at what we've put on that board and say, now, if I was to take every single thing that I've now put onto the board, what might be the logical sequence of those things if I was now to actually put numbers on the board and say, that's really the first thing, and then that's the second thing, and that would be the third thing that I must do off all of that list that I've cascaded onto the board. There's a sequence that needs to be organised. Because there will be a proper order. You can't do everything at once. Something must be the first thing. So what is the first thing? And then when we talk about setting goals in our personal life, we also talk about confirming the reward, because it's well known that the brain is stimulated by the concept of rewards. If there's a reward at the end of the goal or the accomplishment of the goal, it's part of what drives us forward internally. Setting a reward. Now, by the way, it might be a very small goal. It might be that I'm going to clean my room today, and if I successfully accomplish that, I will have a cup of tea. So the cup of tea might be the goal. The goal needs to be commensurate with the reward, and the reward matched to the goal. If it's a very large goal, the reward might be bigger. If it's a very small goal, the reward might be smaller. But the idea of having some sense of reward is critically linked to the vision that we have of goals. And when you think about it, there's some degree of application even in the truth, isn't there? Remember that passage that says, it is the Father's good pleasure to give you the kingdom. And whilst we understand that we want to be in the truth, to manifest the Father and to rejoice in the possibilities that the kingdom will bring to us to accomplish that, the very fact that the Father has promised us those things is a reward beyond compare, beyond comprehension, but it's part of what stimulates our desire to press towards the mark of the prize of the high calling, which is in Christ Jesus. There is a sense of reward associated with the truth, isn't there? Even though we know that our ultimate objective is to manifest the Father in that context. And the real trick to goals, you must set a deadline. I want to go from here to there by then. Without a deadline, and I'm so sorry that that screen is down below me, I can see people starting to do this. So without a deadline, goals, well, you know what they say? A goal without a deadline is simply a dream. It's only when you put a deadline on it that it turns into a goal. Apart from that, it's purely a dream. Goals become real when a deadline's attached to it. And then we've got to commence the actions, and having achieved the goal, we also need to have some mechanism that allows us to quantify the results of our goals once we've achieved them. How did we go? How difficult was it? Was it what we expected? What have we learned from the journey of accomplishing that goal? Now, these might seem like unrelated things to Bible matters, but I think actually they are. They're very closely related to every aspect and every facet of our life in this present mortal probationary period. So I think for all of us, learning not just to set goals, but learning how to achieve goals is an important aspect of our personal growth and development. So I wanted to share with you an idea that I use, which I have found to be extraordinarily helpful, and it's to do with this problem of setting goals and then getting to the end of the year and finding that somehow the goal was never achieved. perhaps even that resolution of what you might seek to do this year. And I think, by the way, that Christadelphians do set goals in the context of New Year resolutions of something they'd like to do spiritually throughout this year. And we get to the end of the year and we think, oh, I didn't do that, and I didn't do that, and I didn't accomplish that. We think, now, why is that? Why is it that we never seem to get around to those? We believed in the goals enough to set them, but we didn't achieve them. We know what the answer is, brothers and sisters. The answer is that the whirlwind of daily life takes over, and suddenly week after week and month after month has gone past and we've never got back to visiting that goal or actually moving it forward. And the reason is because the day-by-day reality of life is not connected to our goals. Ah, that's what we've got to do, you see. We've got to connect what we're doing day-by-day with the goals that we've set. Now, I have a personal process with regard to this, and incidentally, I use this both in my work and also in terms of my personal spiritual life. I use this little piece of paper for both purposes. It's just a little piece of paper. In New Zealand, we have A4 paper, which is not quite the same as US letter. But I found that if I print this little box, I can print it twice, and then I can actually cut that piece of paper in half. And for some reason, that delights my sense of thrift and prudence, that out of that one sheet I've actually got two of these little formulas. And it's a simple piece of paper that says this. It's simply four boxes. So can you imagine a piece of paper with four boxes on it? Doesn't need to be anything more than that, just four boxes. And in the first box we have, surprise surprise, the first goal that we've set for the year, and in the second box, the second goal, and in the third box, the third goal. And incidentally, my recommendation is you don't have any more than three goals. Three goals for your business, even a very large business. A large business, even with thousands of employees, should have only three primary goals at the very most, because the law of diminishing returns says that the moment you go beyond even two goals, the possibility of accomplishing those goals begins to diminish. So three is the maximum. And I have three personal goals in my business for the year, and I also have spiritual goals. So no more than three. And the fourth box is for other things. Do you have any other things to do in life? Oh, yes, we all need the fourth box for other things. Now, here's the problem, brothers and sisters. Well, here's the benefit, at least, of this sheet of paper. Every day I write down on that piece of paper, and it's got a date at the top that I've got on my sheet, and I've got the actual goals written in there, my actual three specific goals, and then I've got a date so that I can fill out a new sheet every day. And one of the things that I then seek to do is to write down, what are my three goals for the year, and what am I going to do today, or in fact tomorrow, that will help to move those three goals forward? What precisely will I do today to move my three primary goals forward? And then box four, what else do I have to do today in terms of other mundane things that unfortunately have to be done? Now, I may have a day, and you may have a day, in fact, I suspect we will both have a day, when you've got a lot of things written in box four, other things. But if you go through day one and day two and day three and day four and day five and suddenly a whole week's gone past and all you've ever done is write stuff in box four, you've got to say, hang on, what's going on with my goals here? Why aren't I moving my goals forward? And the answer is because you're doing too many other things that are distracting you from the goals. And if you keep doing that week after week, it could be that you don't believe in the goals or that you're too scared of the goals, but certainly that you're not committed to the goals. Now, why I find this little sheet helpful, as far as business is concerned, is because I'm self-employed. When you're self-employed, and I do work from home, so the commute's good. But, you know, if I do or don't do anything throughout the day, nobody knows. And of greater importance, nobody cares. So the only person that can hold me accountable for whether I have achieved anything worthwhile on any given day is me. And since every day I write down that tomorrow I want to do something that will move goal one forwards and something that will move goal two forwards and something that will move goal three forward, and I've got other things to do as well, and that little sheet is written up and it sits there on my desk looking at me accusingly saying, well, what are you going to do then? You're going to do this stuff? You're going to move these things forward? And it sits there as my accountability partner to hold me responsible, because nobody else will, so I must do it for myself. And that little piece of paper sits there on my desk every day and tells me, this is what you should be doing today. And it connects me with those goals that actually last for a year, but I must connect with every day. And every day those goals are sitting right in front of me to remind me, these are your goals, remember? Now, I may have a day, as I said, I might even have a week where one of those goals, there's nothing filled out on that particular box. But woe betide me if I come to week two and I haven't put something in that box. I need to say, what are you doing about this goal? So I have found that to be an extraordinarily helpful little piece of paper to sit in front of me every day. Because what it does is it connects goals that tend to be, by their very nature, out a little bit in the distance of time, to the realities of daily life, so that I never lose touch of those goals. So think about that in terms now of not just your mundane activities, but your spiritual goals. Do you have spiritual goals? Have you set spiritual goals? And much more importantly, are you connecting to those every single day of your life to keep you accountable to those intentions that you had in terms of your spiritual growth and development? And that really links to the idea of attention management, you see, because I think the issue here is learning to manage our attention, more than managing our time. The thesis is that focus comes not when we block out our time, but when we book in our attention. It's the management of our attention that we've got to try and somehow get control of. And I think there's some fundamental rules that are helpful even for Christadelphians in terms of the wise use of our attentional powers. The first one is that I always use next action lists to schedule my tasks. You'll notice that there's an interesting choice of phrase there. I don't talk about a to-do list. I talk about a next action list. And the difference between the two is subtle, but huge. Most people have to-do lists filled with things that actually you can't do. It's called a to-do list, but most of them are totally undoable. And the reason why they're undoable is because we haven't thought enough about the task to correctly identify what the real next action actually is. So whatever the thing is that you're thinking of doing, you've got to ask yourself just this one question before you write it down on your list. So what is the very next physical action required to move that thing forward? That's what I must write down. The next action. Nothing more than that, just the next action. But that one single thing written on the list of things you've got to do will transform that into the most powerful list you've ever seen. Next action lists are far more powerful than to-do lists because they've already told the brain precisely what must be done. You don't have to reprocess that item to say, what is it that I've got to do here? There's something powerful about that. And so I review next actions for next day before I finish today. So when I talked about that little box of those four little boxes, I try to write that up at the evening, at the close of my day, before the day finishes, that box for tomorrow is written up and that little piece of paper is sitting on my desk all ready to roll. In fact, if there's a major file of work that I've got to do, that file is already out sitting on my desk waiting for me to tackle it the next morning because I already know what it is that I'm going to do. And I list everything I intend to finish during that coming day. And part of the benefit of those four boxes is this. You learn to distinguish, you see, between what's urgent and what's important. Don't you think we all have a crisis in this particular matter, brothers and sisters, both in our spiritual and our natural lives? What's urgent versus what's important? If you can't distinguish, you'll always default to the tyranny of the urgent. There's a huge difference between those two things. Urgent is driven by time. Important is driven by value. They're not the same thing. Understanding the difference will enable you to fill those four little boxes out more intelligently in terms of what you actually seek to do each day, because what you've got to do is decide on the one item that will have the greatest consequence to help move your goals forward. And generally, it might not be that which is urgent, but it most certainly will be that which is important. What's the one thing that I can do tomorrow that will move my goal forward? And when you come to that new day, fresh and full of enthusiasm, do not say, well, I'll just clear up some small things first. No, no, no. You launch directly into that first major task as the first thing that must be done off that sheet that next morning. First thing to do, the major task. And the sense of accomplishment that brings, and the enthusiasm to tackle other things on that list that that brings, will be enormous, because you've started with the first major thing that should have been done to move one of your goals forward, and you've sought to accomplish that. And that really brings us to the power of work burst cycles, which we mentioned yesterday in our School of the Prophets. And it's based on the reality that human beings are hardwired to pulse in rhythm with our own energy flows. And this discovery first happened in terms of a cycle of 90 minutes when the research into sleep patterns was first being undertaken. And they discovered that sleep patterns through the night go in 90-minute cycles. But they discovered that that same 90-minute cycle that turns up in sleep patterns is actually working in our bodies and in our physiological makeup during the daytime as well. And in fact, it's known as ultradian rhythms. And those patterns of 90 minutes operate in the daytime. Our body goes up to a period of high alert, high productivity, high achievement, and gradually tapers off into a trough after 90 minutes where we're not so good. And then we pick up again into another burst of 90 minutes. Now, if you can understand that and harness the power of that, then you can improve the degree of what you're able to accomplish during the day. So the 90-minute work burst cycle, followed by a break of time, provides for maximum attentional focus and optimal performance. You can't pay attention to something closely all day. It's just not possible. You run out of attentional steam. So managing intense activities and then taking a break, and then another period of intense activity, and then taking a break, turns out to be very productive. Now, I'm talking about this in the context of even work processes, but I think this is absolutely true of spiritual processes, and even in terms of our spiritual study programs. So what we've got to do is to schedule our work burst cycles, and to plot the moments in our day where we could put in. And incidentally, it might not be 90 minutes. You might not have the luxury of 90 minutes. But you might say, I could take 30 minutes, and I could take 30 minutes there and 30 minutes there. Good, then put them into your diary. And then have a work burst moment. And in fact, I think the best way to run a work burst moment is to actually set a timer. I have a little timer that I put on my computer. And I set it for 90 minutes, and away I go. And the very knowledge that the clock is ticking does something to the brain that says, get on, get on, get on, move forward, move forward, move forward, the clock's ticking away. And sure enough, suddenly the alarm goes, I jump out of my skin and the 90 minutes is gone. But I've been on focus, I've been on task. And I think that's good even for something like perhaps Bible study where you just can't study throughout the day. But if you had a moment of time, a work burst that was scheduled to have activity in that area, then that would be a positive way to harness your best attentional powers. Now, they all sound like pretty non-spiritual things, don't they? But at the level of practicality, I believe that Christadelphians need to learn how to be disciplined in managing their attention, because we're on a journey of life to the kingdom, but we still have to run our ordinary lives. We run a double life, not in the sense of double standards, but we run a double life, don't we? I think a lot of people in our workplace environments would be shocked if they knew what Christadelphians did outside of the workplace. They run another whole life that's just as busy, if not more so, than what's going on at work. And so the ability for our attention to be fragmented and distracted, and for our time to be broken, is a real problem for Christadelphians. We of all people have to be able to redeem the time. So we've got to know how to do these things. So practical things that might help us to know how to focus each day, how to set our goals, how to manage bursts of activity, how to be clear on the actions that we're doing on a day-by-day basis. These are all things that are very helpful for Christadelphians who struggle to manage their time and to manage their attention. So let's move to the spiritual side then of this in particular, in terms of what this particular study was about. And it was about not only setting effective spiritual goals, but it was also contemplating biblical examples. Do you know, one of the lovely things about the biblical record is that I think there's good evidence that many Bible people modelled themselves on other Bible people. They were inspired by the example of somebody else in Scripture. And I think this is particularly good for young people, because have you ever been into a young person's room, even within the Christadelphian community, and seen on the walls of their bedroom posters of people? They're not generally posters of Bible people, are they? They're the heroes of the world. They might be in sport, they might be in entertainment, they could be in business. But people seem to love having heroes that they look up to. The only problem with the heroes of the world is that they don't have the truth and they won't be in the kingdom. And in a few years' time, they'll be dead. And the picture on the wall won't look quite so good when they're dead, because they don't offer us anything inspirational that might be helpful as a role model in life. Ah, but when we come to Bible examples, it's a different matter altogether. And biblical people frequently sought to model themselves on a character that had gone before them that they found inspirational. Hezekiah's role model was Solomon. Everything about the record of Hezekiah's life would tell us that he modelled himself on Solomon. He was inspired by Solomon. Nehemiah's role model was Hezekiah. Everything that Nehemiah did tells us that he absolutely was inspired by the example of Hezekiah who'd gone before him. Abigail's role model was Ruth. She was inspired by the example of the story of Ruth in terms of the hope it gave her at a time of difficulty and crisis in her life. Actually, that's a very interesting study in its own right, is having a look at Bible examples who in turn were inspired by other Bible examples. And I think that's a very good idea for us to think about in terms of modelling our lives. Now, of course, we know, brothers and sisters, that the greatest example of all is our Lord Jesus Christ, and we're seeking to walk in the footsteps of Christ, seeking to manifest the Spirit of Christ. But there are other Bible characters that might be helpful to inspire us on that same journey of life towards the kingdom. And not only do I not see anything wrong with that idea, but I think there's every good reason to encourage, particularly young people, to see in Bible examples, in Bible people, a role model that they might be inspired to follow. So I just want to talk about that briefly and to think about that in the context of what that means, and then to provide an example out of my own life in terms of someone who's inspired me, and to ponder perhaps the implications of what it might mean to be inspired by a Bible character. So, you see, I think that Bible characters are outstanding role models, because what we're seeking to do here is to emulate someone who also is committed to manifesting the Father, who also was driven by the Spirit of the truth, who also was walking towards the kingdom. And isn't that the point of the Bible examples that we've been given? Is that they're here to encourage us on the journey of life. So why don't we seek to be more deliberate about that? And instead of simply saying, well, these people are all interesting, why don't we study Bible characters with a little more intensity of detail to be conscious that we might deliberately tread in their steps and seek to understand the secrets of how they lived their lives of faithfulness and dedication? So a couple of examples, just by way of illustration. The first is Jonathan, who I think was inspired by Gideon. Now you ask yourself the question, if you were Jonathan, Who would you look to be inspired by? And obviously you'd think about a character that came before you. Jonathan was going to be a faithful warrior, wasn't he? Jonathan was going to do what his father Saul couldn't do. In fact, it's quite evident when you think about it that Jonathan probably wasn't inspired by his father. So Jonathan had to find another character that might inspire him for his own aspirations and spiritual things to render excellence in his service to the Father. And he found a man. He found a man called Gideon that he felt a sense of kinship with. And somehow the record is woven together in such a way that I think we're led to the conclusion that Gideon was the role model that guided Jonathan, the role model that inspired Jonathan. And I'm asking you to think about this, you see, in terms of your own life, is, well, could you think of someone in the Bible that might be a similar source of inspiration and of direction to you in terms of your own spiritual growth? Now, because of time, we won't turn these passages up, but I'll just make reference to them. Do you know, in the book of Judges in chapter 6, in the life of Gideon, and in the book of the first of Samuel chapter 14 in the life of Jonathan, you will find that both men proposed a sign that would indicate whether God was would be fighting for them or no. They both sought an answer from heaven by proposing a sign that could be used as the indicator that Almighty God would be with them in a particular enterprise that they sought to engage in. Why did Jonathan decide to do that? I think he'd learnt that, you see, from the life of Gideon. He did the same thing. Well, his sign was different, but it was the same idea. In Judges chapter 7 and the first of Samuel chapter 14, we find that both of these men learned and appreciated that God could deliver either by many or by few. And because they believed in the overwhelming power of God, it mattered not to them how many or how few might be involved. They trusted implicitly in the power of their God to bring deliverance, irrespective of the number of people involved. And so you'll remember the story of Gideon from that perspective, of the few men that in the end would defeat the Midianites. And in the case of Jonathan, how few were the men? Why, only he and his servant, his faithful servant, that would come with him on the occasion of one of Jonathan's most illustrious battles. Oh yes, both of these men understood that truth, that God could deliver by many or by few. But I think that Jonathan learned that lesson by studying the life of Gideon and being inspired by him. In Judges chapter 7 again, in the first of Samuel 14, in fact, the interesting thing is that both of them did the same thing. They took their faithful servant with them into the very lair of the enemy. Didn't Gideon take Phurah, his servant, right into the camp of the Midianites? And didn't Jonathan take his armor bearer with him, climbing the mountain to where the Philistines stood in the garrison above? And that faithful servant came with them on both occasions. And I wonder, you see, whether Jonathan was conscious when he asked his armor bearer to come with me, whether he was thinking of Phurah, the servant of Gideon that went to the camp of the Midianites, you see, and that he was consciously modeling himself on an example of a faithful man who'd gone before him. In Judges chapter 7, again, in 1 Samuel 14, the record expressly tells us that the salvation that was wrought in the days of Gideon came because God set every man's sword against his fellow in the midst of the Midianites. And when Jonathan would win his victory against the Philistines, having climbed the height to the garrison, the record expressly tells us that the battle went against the Philistines because, why, God set every man's sword against his fellow. And it quotes exactly the same phrase in terms of the victory that would be achieved by both of these men on two separate occasions. And lastly, in Judges chapter 7 and 1 Samuel 14, we will understand, will we not, that both of these men galvanized others into joining the battle by their own heroic action. Because we're expressly told that when others saw what Gideon had achieved, they came and joined. And we're told in the 1 Samuel chapter 14 that when others saw what Jonathan had managed to achieve, they came and joined the battle. And that's ever been the case, hasn't it, brothers and sisters? That it takes the faithful spirit of one, and suddenly others will come. But who's the one that will climb the hill in the first place? That's the burning issue. And Jonathan wanted to climb that hill, but he believed, because of the story of Gideon, that God could likewise in his life save by few, and that he would in fact be with him on this occasion as he was with Gideon. And so he marched, I think, in the very spirit of Gideon, and a similar victory was achieved. And others joined the battle because of the spirit of Jonathan's action, just as they had in the days of Gideon. Now, there's something very encouraging about that idea, isn't there? Because if you were to read that story and compare the two, you'll find, I think, you'll be absolutely convinced that Jonathan, he used Gideon as his inspiration. So he found a Bible character and he modelled himself on it. Don't you think that's a good idea? I think that's an excellent idea. Do you think that that meant that the life of Gideon was true and real as far as Jonathan was concerned? He lived the spirit of Gideon. He knew that story inside out and back to front. He read that story, heard about that story, nurtured that story in his very being. It inspired him. I think that's what the Bible should be like. And that's what the Bible's for us to go away and do that. So the question is, who's your hero or heroine in the Bible that might be a similar source of inspiration to you, to encourage you in the journey of life, above and beyond our Lord Jesus Christ, whose steps we will always seek to follow? Well, here's another interesting example. The spirit of Deborah. You see, I think that Deborah was inspired by Miriam. She looked back in the record and she found a woman that had gone before her, and she thought, that's the spirit that I need to inspire me in my own journey. You know, in the book of Exodus chapter 15 concerning Miriam, and in the book of Judges chapter 4 concerning Deborah, it's clear that both of these sisters were prophetesses who saw wider issues in the overthrow of the enemy of the day. It wasn't just the destruction of Pharaoh's host. It wasn't just the destruction of Sisera and his army. No, these two sisters saw the battle as having the overtones of the conquest against sin itself and the final purpose of God. There was something greater at work, something greater at play here, and these sisters had a sense of that greatness in the circumstances of their own day. And I think that Miriam was inspirational to Deborah in that regard, that Deborah saw that Miriam had a greater breadth of understanding concerning the events of the triumph of the house of Israel over Pharaoh and his host who perished in the sea. In Exodus chapter 14 and Judges chapter 4, we will learn that they both faced an enemy that was mighty in horses and chariots. And I think that was one of the things that inspired Deborah to know that there's a woman who'd gone before him who was in exactly the situation that she would find herself in the days of the oppressor that came down upon the land. In Micah chapter 6 and Judges chapter 5, we will learn concerning both Miriam and Deborah that they were sent before the nation for deliverance. God selected them at this critical moment in the history of the nation, and they were used for that purpose, associated with the deliverance of their people. Again, in Exodus chapter 4 and Judges chapter 5, both of these sisters witnessed a victory by means of the onrush of water. And lastly, in both Exodus 15 and Judges chapter 5, both Miriam and Deborah would sing the song of praise to God for the nation's deliverance once it had been accomplished, and they would burst forth into a song that was prophetic in its tone. And you stop and ask yourself this question, you see, is when Deborah looked for an example to inspire her, who do you think she could look to? Think about it. Who could Deborah look to? Think about the context of this. Who could she have as a role model? She was a prophetess. That was unusual. And she was the spiritual leader of the nation at the time, which was unique. Who would she look to as an example? And what she did, what Deborah did, was she looked up to the one woman who might be seen to have matched her experience in the nation, and that was Miriam. Was there anyone else, really, in the Bible record that Deborah could look to in her particular situation? Miriam was the obvious example for her to look to as a role model to be encouraged by and guided by. In fact, in Miriam's day, there were faithful men that led the congregation. There were none in Deborah's day. Barak had to be urged to his responsibilities by Deborah herself. And yet she did not seek to supplant him. In fact, I wonder, based on that reference in the book of Numbers, chapter 12, whether she'd learned the lesson of Miriam, who, you remember, on one occasion spoke against Moses. And Miriam was rebuked by God. So Deborah never speaks against Barak. Never seeks to supplant him. I think she learned the lesson of the problem in Miriam's life, but she was nevertheless inspired by Miriam's spirit and Miriam's actions. In fact, I wonder whether Deborah saw in the deliverance of the nation from Sisera a repetition of Israel's deliverance from Pharaoh, and that just as Israel had begun life afresh after Pharaoh's host drowned, so now might the nation begin spiritually again. After the victory wrought against Sisera, I think Deborah saw all of those possibilities. As she was inspired by a sister in the Bible that she'd learned enough about to see her as her role model. So there's some questions. If we were to be inspired by a man or a woman, a brother or a sister in the biblical record, perhaps these are the questions that we should ask ourselves. You see, it's not good enough to be general about this. You would need to be specific in order for that role model to be of benefit to you. So the first question would be, who's your special Bible hero whose example you admire? I think that actually most Christadelphians have favourite Bible stories. And incidentally, I don't think there's anything wrong with that at all. Some of us have favourite psalms. And we might have favourite Bible characters. Who's yours? But the question is why? What is it there? What is it about the example of that person, as the Bible record writes them up? What is there about that person that inspires you, or that you especially admire? What particular Bible character inspires you, and what is it about what they did that might be a source of inspiration to you? Do you know what that is? Have you thought about it? Thought about it deeply enough to understand why that might be inspirational to you? Only if we do that, if we think enough about that, deeply enough about it, will we get to the point of where that association might be beneficial. So then the next question is, what role, consistent with that example, would you seek to fulfil in the kingdom? Now I should just say, and you know that I know, but so that you know that I know, the Father will decide what all of us will do in the kingdom. I understand that. But would you like to do something in the kingdom? Have you ever thought about specifically what you'd like to do in the kingdom? Is the kingdom real enough to all of us that we have a particular task that we would dearly love to be engaged in, and we set our heart now as we walk towards the kingdom, is that we're specific about that opportunity in the kingdom, that we might do that to the Father's honour? Whether the Father grants us that is another matter altogether, and in a sense it matters not. But to set our heart on what we could do, that's a good thing. So what would that be? What role do you see yourself as being able, possibly, to fulfil in the kingdom to the honour of Yahweh's name? Have you ever thought about that? Or is the kingdom just something that's always general? We've got to make it specific, brothers and sisters. What skills would you need to accomplish that task to Yahweh's honour? What would you need to do that in the kingdom for God's name? And lastly, what steps are you taking now to develop those special abilities for possible future service? See, this is about making the kingdom real, isn't it? And if we're to have a Bible role model that inspires us, I think it's part of this reality of moving towards the kingdom with such intensity of purpose that we already have our heart set on what we might do in the kingdom for the good of Yahweh's name. And whatever it is that the Father graces us with at that time, we will, of course, gladly accept, knowing that the Father knows best. But it matters not at all that we might not set our heart on such a thing even now and make the kingdom real to us. So here's an example of someone who's inspired me. And I've put this down just to show you what the implications are, because in talking about this, what I'd like you to think about is that it's not enough to just know about that person in the Bible, and it's not enough even to simply read their story in the Bible. What you've got to think about is, well, what would I need to do? What do I practically need to outwork as a result of having that inspirational role model in Scripture? I hope that we're all allowed to have more than one. But here's one of mine. I'm inspired by a man called Asaph. And I want to explain why and what that's done in my life so that you can see how my particular Bible role model has wrought specific change and intention in my life. Just as an illustration of what I guess we're trying to explain in this whole idea. See, I'm inspired by Asaph because he was able to set a flame in the hearts and the minds of his family that burned with such passion that family kept the truth for the next 600 years. It's such an astounding example of faithful family life and the truth that I don't know of any to compare with it in the divine record. In its totality, I don't know of any to compare with it. I'm inspired by that. And I'm inspired by Asaph because I know that he knew the spirit of acceptable praise before God, and that the music of that family should be the very benchmark of how we offer praise today. This family knew how to sing before God in such a way that God accepted that praise. There's nothing that we couldn't learn about this household in terms of how acceptable praise might be offered. I'm inspired by that man's example. I'm inspired because his family, in their successive generations, received the divine revelation of God. How astonishing that a son and a grandson and a great-great-grandson of the father, Asaph himself, should in their various generations receive revelations from Almighty God again and again and again through this one family. What faithfulness was that God would be pleased to visit them in such a way down through generations. And wherever this family were, they always held the truth aloft in such a way that it lifted the rest of the nation to a more exalted spirit than they would have shown if that house was not there. Oh yes, I'm inspired by that man. How did he do that in his family? I'm inspired by the possibilities of that. But here's what that means. You see, Asaph was a musical man. And as part of the implications of being inspired by him, I have a particular regard for music, but with regard to this man. And I respond to music. I love music. And I love music so powerfully that I can feel it as a physical tide washing over my body. That's not an exaggeration. That's how I feel music. I feel it in every particle of my being. It's such a powerful thing. And you might guess what type of music I've got in mind when I talk about this, because I can understand the mathematical precision of a partita by Bach, or the singing cantabile of a song by Mendelssohn, or the brilliant harmonic of an etude by Schumann, or the strong stirring of a polonaise by Chopin, or the bright elegance of a sonata by Mozart, or the stern, exalted spirit of a hymn by Brahms, or the tragic majesty of a symphony by Beethoven, or the sad pathos of a concerto by Rachmaninoff. I can feel all of those. And I love them all. But because of the spirit of Asaph, I have to know that the feelings brought forth within me by that music are totally consistent with all that's good and all that's wholesome and all that's pure in the truth. That's what Asaph does to me. Whatever music I listen to, I've got to know that it's consistent with the objectives of the truth, that it will not damage that in any way. I love the range of colour and light and excellence and mastery in good music. I'm astounded by the weaving of multitudinous threads of sound into the tapestry of music. There's something gloriously unbelievable about good music. And I've chosen, because of Asaph, never to listen to music that I believe to be inconsistent with the principles of melody in the kingdom, or to music that might give me a distaste for the hymns that we sing within our community. I don't want to listen to music that might do that, because I'm inspired by Asaph. And because I've been inspired by his spirit, I've studied to understand how music affects both the body and the mind, so as to understand what key principles sit behind what types of music will best fulfill the spiritual objectives of our praise, because I want to understand that, because I'm inspired by that man. I've studied the House of Asaph to trace their story through the scriptural record and to completely familiarise myself with every little detail of that story. I know this family. I know this family as if I've met them all. I've studied the House of Asaph to understand their hymns and the key tenets and the guiding standards that made their offerings of praise acceptable to God as a fragrant incense over many generations. Oh yes, I've studied them. I've studied the House of Asaph to understand what their secrets to extraordinary faithfulness were. I wanted to know those secrets, the secrets of this family, and how those secrets might be employed in the service of the truth in our own times. And it all began with Father Asaph. I was inspired by him and what was possible in the service of the truth. In one family, by the power of music, to exalt the mind to spiritual things. And it's also meant that I've studied to understand the scriptural basis and the spiritual depth of the hymn book so that I can sing with deep understanding. I've marked my hymn book so I know where it's coming from scripturally. And I stand up and sing a hymn and I'm transported into a cascade of Bible passages that have all been woven into that hymn. If only we could but know, but they're there. And now I sing with understanding, because there's no other way to sing, is there, that will render praise to God other than to sing with understanding? And because I've been inspired by this man, I focus on every closing voluntary at the meetings for three reasons. I want to recognise the hymn, I want to know before it finishes why I think the organist has chosen it, and I want to listen to how the organist plays to decide what verse they were playing and why they chose that verse. And because I've been inspired by this man, I always seek to find and use hymns that will be special for each occasion and that will capture the spirit of the study and help to exalt the thinking of the ecclesia that will bring us all into the presence of God in a final incense of prayer through praise. Oh yes, I've been inspired by Asaph. But this is what it means to have a role model. it's got to have an impact in your life. It's got to be part of how your life will be shaped in the walk of the truth because of the inspiration of that Bible character. And if that's true, brothers and sisters, what might I desire to do in the kingdom? What thinkest thou? Can you imagine being part of the immortal choir of the temple of the age to come? It's hard to comprehend the wonder of what such songs would be like. If I'm not chosen to be a member, I hope at least to be there and to be able to sing alongside them, brothers and sisters, because that will be a thing of joy, to sing with an immortal voice and with everlasting thankfulness. So I think there's something about Bible characters that are so wonderfully helpful to us, but I wonder whether we could do more and whether we could do better in taking hold of those characters and making them a source of inspiration and guidance in our lives, that they become so real to us that when we finally meet them in the kingdom, we will shake their hand and say, "Brother Asaph, it's lovely to meet you, but I've known you for a long time." Shall we close with a comment about that same intensity of purpose and dedication and commitment to the truth from Brother Thomas? Just to remind ourselves that the truth is very real and very serious, and we ought to be committed to it. It's one of the loveliest things Brother Thomas said, but then it's a favourite passage. And Brother Thomas once said this. He said, "When someone is deeply and continuously engaged in an atmosphere of divine thoughts, they have neither the time nor inclination to plot mischief or play the fool. This is the vocation of vacant minds and idle hands, who know not what it is to enter within the veil. It is essential to contentment, if not to happiness, to be engaged in something for oneself or for an object dearer than self. You know, brothers and sisters, all my life I've wanted to understand the things that lie beyond the veil. And God willing, we all shall, because the forerunner has entered for us. But we've got to be committed to the journey. God pray that he give us strength for that endeavour."